Welcome. It seems to me that when looking around at all the different religions in the world and different spiritual practices that may not even consider themselves religions, that they have many things in common. They seem to all teach and promote and the practice of kindness and compassion and generosity and ethical conduct, patience, maybe even mindfulness. We kind of feel maybe that Buddhism is kind of got the trademark on mindfulness, but in fact I think going by different names, I think probably almost all religions would have some kind of paying attention to what we're doing and being present. And they all have some kind of devotion. So there's nothing to me that seems unique in the Buddha Dharma or Zen practice in these terms. This is just standard religion or spirituality. And it's good that all these different faith traditions emphasize these things. We might even say that's these qualities, these practices, these wholesome tendencies are what bring all these traditions together and bring people together and help us live in harmony. So then we could say, oh, well, so they're basically all teaching these same things. So we could take up any one of them, and some of us do take up multiple traditions. But why Buddha Dharma? What's unique about this? Some might say it's the practice of, probably a lot of people would say, the practice of silent sitting is really emphasized in Zen, and that's what draws me to it. But I would also propose that what's to me seems most unique about Buddha Dharma is the view, the understanding of how things are. I think this is actually all these different traditions, even though the practices are almost the same, very similar, the views is different, it seems to me. Maybe quite similar, but I think to me that's what makes Buddha Dharma unique. And when I reflect on getting into practice myself, I think this was a big part of it. Yes, sitting meditation was part, but I think many of us come to first discover Buddhism or Zen through reading something about it. Occasionally we might get introduced by a friend, but usually read something about it, and maybe you just read about meditation, but it probably comes along with some worldview or understanding of how things are. Even in the simplest Zen books, it starts pointing towards a way of looking at ourselves in the world. So for me, I think that was probably the initial thing was this seems like a really great way to try on viewing myself and the world, this kind of understanding. And then, oh, it does come with a practice. And we can, besides learning the understanding, we can enact it and open it and develop it and realize it through our meditation practice. And then, of course, there's other things unique to Zen, somewhat unique, like it has nice gardens and has a lot of like varnished wood, stained wood. I like those things. These are like kind of Japanese aesthetics. I mean, I love that stuff. But that's not really why I practice it. Although this maybe is part of the hook for some of us, even since ancient times. We love the aesthetics. And we love the practice, but I don't know, maybe it's somewhat unusual to me, but I love the view, the understanding. And I love checking out all different schools of Buddhism, too. So partly the reason I've stuck with Zen is because of the view. Because the practices, like if you go down to Insight Santa Cruz, the Vipassana Center, the sitting meditation is basically the same. We have a little bit more formality and stuff, but this sitting is sitting. And maybe people are doing the same practices, but I think as we go along, we see that actually even there within different schools of Buddhism, the understanding or view is somewhat different. So you could say, what makes Mahayana Buddhism unique and different from Theravada Buddhism or early foundational Buddhism? I would say not so much the practice. The practice maybe a little bit, but I think it's the view. The understanding actually changes. What makes Zen unique within the whole Mahayana Great Vehicle Buddhism? What makes the Zen tradition unique? To me, it seems like actually it's the view, the understanding of how things are. You might think that sounds weird, or maybe you just discover Zen and it's the first meditation or Buddhism you discover, and we just think, well, that's what it all is. But as we study it more, we see that actually there are different understandings. So, to me, this right view, right understanding, it's the first of the Eightfold Path. It sets up the rest, right conduct and right speech and right mindfulness even, are all based on the view. The understanding of how things are. I think the last talk I gave here, I mentioned this quote from Suzuki Roshi that I came across from 1967. He says, we live in the world of time and space, and our life does not go beyond this limit. To live in the world of time and space is like pushing a big snake into a small can. The snake will suffer in the small can because it doesn't know what's going on outside the can. It's so dark in this can, and the snake will struggle in there. That's what we are doing. And the more we struggle, the greater the suffering will be. That kind of practice will not work. And then here's the part that surprised me. And he said, putting yourself in a small can of time and space and sitting day after day in a cross-legged position is worse than a waste of time. So I hear this as, you can put yourself on a cushion and be present and settle into the present, but we still, there's this feeling maybe like I'm a person living in this small can called time and space, and I'm sitting day after day like that. It's a little bit extreme, I think, to say it's worse than a waste of time, because actually I think it has some benefits. It calms us down. But I thought it was a strong statement on this particular day. Suzuki Roshi said, just to sit there without understanding what it is to be in the can and what's outside the can, it's worse than a waste of time, even if we're sitting day after day. He says, do you understand? Sometimes our practice is something like this. We don't know how much our understanding is limited, or our view of how things are. So that's why there's the whole world of studying Dharma. And I think we do open to the view and the understanding first through conceptual teachings. We hear, we read teachings. And then, of course, we bring them into practice. It's not just a matter of conceptual understanding, but the understanding and the view is quite subtle. And I think that we don't necessarily get it just by sitting. It doesn't just come to us. I think that's what Suzuki Roshi is saying. It's in this talk, he later goes on to say, that's why we need koans. Because this is a Zen version of clarifying the view or understanding, besides just being present. But there's many ways to develop our understanding. Philosophy. The Greek word philosophy means the love of wisdom. A philosopher is one who loves knowledge or wisdom. I think the Buddha, in that way, was a philosopher. And again, I think this is what makes Buddha Dharma unique. And we should keep emphasizing and practicing and talking about kindness and compassion and generosity and ethical conduct, these universal spiritual qualities, just like all religions ought to, but also keep remembering our unique offering of this particular and a kind of unusual radical understanding of the Buddha's and Zen ancestors. And we might say a philosopher loves wisdom just for its own sake. I feel this way sometimes. I love learning. I just love continuously learning as my life goes on. It's for my personality, that's like that passion just grows and grows, and it just like my heart sings when I learn, especially learning about the nature of things and myself. It's the most fun. I know all people are different. Some think like I don't like to think so much. In fact, that's why I come to Zen, because I can stop thinking. So I think there's that too. But as a philosopher, as a lover of wisdom, I often feel compelled to talk about this kind of thing. So, and I think that it does affect that's the point in Buddhism, is not so much just for its own sake. Or we might even say, what about just to be in accord with reality? Isn't that a virtue in itself? For me, I'd say, yeah. It might even be, some might even consider it the highest value. I just don't want to be duped by my own experience and live in illusion. So I just want to like open to reality just to be in accord with reality so I can live this life in truth. Some might, maybe philosophers feel that way. Some might say, well, that's kind of, it's not very practical. What's so great about living in accord with truth? So also, I think, living in accord with truth and understanding actually does affect the way we live in the world. It affects our conduct. I think I might have brought this example up before, but the classic metaphor of it's about understanding and misperception that the Buddhas offer is like seeing a rope. I mean, seeing a snake in the dark, and seeing this poisonous snake. There's a poisonous snake on this mountain. We should watch out for it. And we see it. It's frightening. And both our emotions are affected by this perception of a snake, fear and our hearts beating fast, maybe fear and anxiety, maybe even anger or aversion. These are emotions arise from this understanding that we're seeing a snake. And then the conduct, our conduct based on our emotions might actually be based on perceiving this as a snake. For example, we might try feeling particularly violent. If it's not moving off that one path we need to go on, we might try to even kill it or harm it in some way out of this aversion to it, and it's in my way. So this is an example of how both emotions and conduct arise from this view or understanding that we're seeing a snake. But then we look closer, we see it's not a snake. In the dark it looked like a snake, it's really just a rope. And with this change of view, our misperception is relieved. Now we see the rope. The emotion changes, doesn't it? The fear dissipates. Sudden relief. Our heart stops pounding. It might take a little while, but our heart's going to stop pounding. The fear is going to dissipate. We feel a little bit silly at being so afraid and upset about this creature. And our conduct changes. We were about to kill the snake. Now it's just like we have no violent urge. So maybe it's a stretch, but I think you could imagine how this metaphor might actually apply to real life situations. If we think another person, it has their own independent self that's controlling their body and mind, we think that then we can blame them for something, right? If we see that actually they're just nothing but just constant churning of arising and ceasing conditions, we see there's nobody actually to blame. So the emotion is different and the context is different. If we see something that we really want that's outside of ourself, we might feel a lot of greed and try to get it, and then we might actually act on it and try to get it, even if it's not ours, for example. But if we can see this is not actually outside ourself, it's not something separate from ourself, then both the afflictive emotions and the actions that arise from these emotions dissipate. Sometimes it's said that our true nature, our Buddha nature, is perfectly fine and complete the way it is, but it seems to be obscured or obstructed by various things, and that's the issue. So the issue is working with these obstructions or obscurations. And they're sometimes listed as three different types, like Nyeya Avarana is the most subtle type of obscuration, and that's basically the belief in duality, the belief that things and others are separate from ourself. But based on that obstruction, cognitive obstruction, you could translate it as, based on that cognitive obscuration, there's emotional obscurations, klesha avarana. These are like greed, hate, and delusion, pride and jealousy, and doubt, and so on. These arise from the cognitive obscurations, the emotional obscurations, and then based on the emotional obscurations, there's karma avarana, the obscurations due to our intentional actions, our karmic activity, our conduct in the world, really kind of solidifies our delusion even more. So they all work together. The cognitive obscurations give rise to the emotional obscurations which give rise to karmic obscurations. And all of them, all these obscurations that seem to be hiding our true, peaceful, radiant, loving nature sometimes, are all based on our misunderstanding or false view. So really, I think it is, like, for me, it seems to be the main issue in Buddha Dharma. And right view, one of the reasons I was drawn to Buddha Dharma is that the view is presented as having to withstand the test of reason and logic and analysis, and also be able to withstand the test of our own experience, direct experience, and our life. Our view must be tested by our life. Because even if we have a logically coherent view, but it doesn't result in kindness and compassion, then it's actually, I would say, it's not really the right view. We're slightly misunderstanding, or we maybe even conceptually understand the right view, but we're not really applying it fully. So it should be logically coherent, and it should result in peace and kindness and compassion. All those go together. So, our usual view to get into the understanding of Dharma. Within Buddha Dharma, there's many different views and understandings. I don't know, see how far we get, but our kind of pre-practice view, our default view, our default understanding, the Buddhas say, is, you know, before we've heard anything about any philosophy or religion or anything, at least the proposal is that the default view of all sentient beings, humans and animals and so on, is that I seem to be an independent, singular, permanent, individual self. Either I have one of those, or I am one of those. Maybe I think the default view is usually presented as that I am a singular, permanent, independent, individual, essential thing. And when we look at, well, what is that? We feel as if it's something like this body and mind. When we start to hear religious views, then we hear things about that's my soul or something. But I think our intuition, our default intuition, is actually this body and mind is this independent, separate, permanent entity. But as soon as we start examining our body and mind, we see that that doesn't make any sense, because the body is constantly changing and the mind is constantly changing. So it's not a coherent view, but interestingly, it seems to be our intuitive sense that that's what I am, even though as soon as we start looking at it, it doesn't make sense. But we can see various reasons why it might become a kind of habit, a habitual way of thinking of ourself. Yes.
Very quickly, would you maybe say it was our instinct to feel that way?
Yeah, instinct, I think, works. Mm-hmm. Yeah, our instinct. And this tradition teaches that we're actually born with this view. It's as a little infant, it's not very apparent yet, because it hasn't been unfolded, it hasn't been unpackaged. It's like the program hasn't been unleashed yet, but it's like it's set up and it's very quickly taught by the big people who are already have their package unfolded. So they don't have to, even if they try to not teach us that, they can't help it because they're all assuming that they are some kind of like self, independent, singular, individual self. And then we identify ourselves with this body and mind. Be like, I am this body and mind, even though the body and mind seems to be constantly changing. And this body, mind, person feels as if it's singular and permanent and independent. It means like it exists on its own. Independent, I think, is a really key thing. We know as soon as we start thinking about it that our body and mind is dependent on other bodies and minds and the things around us. But we feel as if there's something here. And I think the experiential way that this plays out is it feels like there's a kind of owner of the body and mind, a possessor of the body and mind. Someone who's having my experience. That's why I say my experience. This is my experience right now. Well, who's the my you're referring to? The self. I might say, oh, it's just the experience of this changing body and mind. But to me, when my instinctual sense is that, no, it feels like there's somebody other than the constantly changing collection of stuff with no particular identity. It feels like there's an identity in here, sort of connected with the body and mind. It's when we start looking at it, it starts to unravel and it doesn't make sense. Because it's actually a false view, according to the Buddha, that there's this independent self. But it still feels that way. So that's one of the teachings the Buddha offers, is that this default, instinctual, innate view is actually doesn't hold up when we start looking at it. And maybe we've all done this to some extent, because we probably heard this kind of thing. It doesn't really make sense. There's nothing unchanging here in this body and mind experience. It's just, it's coming and going. And yet, we look at that and we think, at least that's my experience. I look at it and say, wow. I never noticed that before. Maybe when we first hear that, we can even feel a little shift of perspective. I really can't find any singular, independent, individual, essential self in this changing flux of stuff. Interesting. Buddhism's interesting. And then I go about my life, oh, I need to do this now. I need to do that. And like, don't say that to me. We need to just revert back to the innate view, right? So which is a nice example of how we can hear this kind of thing and it doesn't touch. Maybe it slightly touches our daily life experience. And I think that's sometimes why people might say, philosophy doesn't really have anything to do with my daily life. Because if you just think about it a little bit, it doesn't really affect our life. But of course the Buddha doesn't say, okay, that's good enough, you heard it, you're enlightened now. No! For one thing, we have to hear it again and again, and we have to examine all the details around it. We have to really love wisdom to ask all the questions and resolve all the doubts around this, and then test it in our own experience and our own direct experience. Like, it's great. We might feel like when things that were smoothly going through the day, it's just a body and mind going through the day. But then that little thing happens, right? Somebody insults us or says something a little bit, right? We don't like. And then immediately, they shouldn't have said that to me. It's not fair. Maybe even the idea, it's not fair, is revealing the view of the independent self. So, I thought I just discovered that that's not a valid view, but there it is again. So, that's why again and again, and like Suzuki Roshi's saying, we don't need to just sit in the small can of our default view, like, yeah, I'm a person sitting zazen, I did my zazen today, even though I planned the my calendar for next week during that period. I stayed on the cushion. So, you know, there's so much more. Even just being present, we might, I think just being present and letting go of our thought, actually, we do start to accord more with this view of no independent self naturally. But it happens very slowly, and it's I think that's why we like to sit and stop thinking as much as we can, because it does get closer to reality, but we don't really know why necessarily, so we just do the present thing again. Could be valid practice, but I think to actually investigate in the stillness and concentration of zazen, these issues of view and understanding, is, to me, that's what I really love. To take the conceptual idea and, like, bring it into direct experience in all different kinds of situations, in zazen and outside zazen. And it's hard, and it's a long process. So that's one view. And sometimes it's said, in this foundational view of Buddha Dharma, that there's no independent self here, but there really is a world of stuff. Usually, even in the foundational teachings, they say the conglomerations of stuff are kind of what we might call conventional truths, but the atoms that they're made of are really stuff. This is, like, to me it's interesting that 500 BC, or maybe a little bit after the Buddha's time, this idea of atoms was long before scientists discovered what we call atoms. They had this view that all this stuff must be made of something. If we keep dividing it up and look closer and closer, there must be something that it's all made of, right? This stuff. So they call it paramanu, or atoms. And they're like indivisible particles. So there's no independent self, but these particles that make up the world, they're real in this early Buddhist view. And so then you could say that still leaves some room for grasping and also separation, because it'd be like, say, Michael has no independent self, but he's a body and mind, and I have no independent self, but I'm a body and mind. So neither one, we might feel much less afflicted in our conversation, because there's no controller of our bodies and minds, but it still feels a little bit separate. You feel like you're still a body and mind over there, I'm a body and mind over here. Maybe, so the language is getting tricky. It's not like I am, but there's a body and mind over here talking to a body and mind over there. So it still feels like we're a little separate, even though there's no independent, essential individual self. Can you follow that? So the first view is that there's no independent self, but there really are bodies and minds, and they're separate from each other, and there really is a world separate from mind made of atoms. Can you follow how you can have the view that there's a world made of atoms and there's separate bodies and minds without having the view of a separate independent self? Can you follow that? Anyone not follow that?
It's the view of physics. There is a point,
yes.
There is a way.
Yeah, it's a, yeah, so
it's
physics.
It's quantum physics.
Well, it's getting, so physics is, so first of all, this point of atoms is like pre-quantum physics, right?
Back to the Greeks.
But
there was one Greek, I can't remember his name, who actually knew that the anthems was not true, that the anthems was indivisible.
Oh, okay.
I can't think of his name. Agaras. For a long time.
Yeah.
So he had an intuition, actually, that matter was not all solid, and there was not an ultimate content of matter.
But it's pretty good concept, I think, that to think that there are atoms too. It's a kind of a normal assumption to think that there must be some building blocks of this world.
Or some essence.
Some essence. Some, and particularly some physical material basis for a physical material world. That's what we call, in philosophy language, we call realism or materialism. This is Western philosophy. Did you have a question? Realism in the dictionary is the doctrine or the teaching that objects of sense perception or cognition exist independently of the mind. That's interesting. And two different definitions, that's how they define realism as a philosophical. There's these atoms that whether or not there's any consciousness in the world, there are atoms. There's a world before there's consciousness. That's view is called realism in Western philosophy. Or materialism is also, we're not talking about being materialistic, like wanting to be rich or something, but the philosophical view of materialism is the theory that physical matter is the only reality or the fundamental reality, and that all phenomena are manifestations or results of physical matter. That's the view of materialism. And that is, as I understand it, the early Buddhist view. It was materialism or realism. There's no independent self, but there's a world made of atoms. So one of the nice reasonings, this is my favorite logical reasoning these days, that really it's worth exploring, and I haven't fully explored it. It's a nice one that Vasubandhu brings up, and I think maybe others too, to kind of like examine if there is this world separate from consciousness made up of atoms. They started thinking about atoms in this way that that again, more modern people think of molecules are like when you put atoms together, right? You make a structure. So they thought of the world is made of these kind of indestructible, permanent, unchanging substance called atoms, partless particles, I mean, they can't be divided. And the way that the world becomes is that you join, you have one part of this particle, and then you put four around it and two on these sides, right? So it's a seven particle molecule. Sort of drawn a picture, but you follow that? It's just like a three-dimensional shape. You have one central atom, you have a top, a bottom, a right, a left, and a front and a back, and that makes dimensionality or extension, we call it, right? And then as soon as you have extension, you can just keep adding these molecules together, and pretty soon you have a Zendo and a Santa Cruz and a mountain and a river and stuff like this, right? Pretty good early physics, right? Early Indian physics. But Vasubandhu's argument is that if you say, the proposal is that these are partless particles, because if you could divide a particle into more parts, then it's not partless. So they're saying there's these substantial things that very, very tiny, they can't be divided. He said if they're really partless, they must be like one point. Because if they're very, very tiny, but they still have a top and a bottom, they can be divided. Can you follow this? If to be a partless particle, it has to be literally one point with no extension, no dimension or extension. So the problem with this is that if you try to build a Zendo from partless particles with no extension, it's like putting two points. If you try to put two points together, they're the same point. They literally have no extension, right? The two points collapse into each other, and you don't have any, you can't build from it, right? all six atoms would be the same, at the same position. Can you follow that? If the atom has no extension, then you can't build things with extension from it. So you might see like, this is a really weird way. Why do people think this way? But if you, this is maybe a thing, something you can take home. I've been really contemplating this for a while, this particular example. And it does something to the mind to contemplate this. You have to really kind of work it and reason. Like, so what? And if you can't, you know, you could say, well, okay, then maybe there can be a partless particle. That's where you usually go. You see that there, if they're really just one point with no extension, it won't work to build a universe from that. So maybe they're very tiny particles with some extension. But then you're back to this problem of, if it's tiny but has a top and a bottom, it can be divided. And as soon as it can be divided, there's nothing there. There's no source. There's no essential thing. It can be divided endlessly. So it's either or. Either it's partless point with no extension, which means you can't have a world, or it has a little bit of extension, but then you can divide it, and that you can't, so you can't find an essential substance. And this is getting kind of similar to quantum physics, I think, is when we look for material basis, the smallest type of material basis. Now the scientists are not finding it. So I think that's a great argument that Vasubandhu uses to show, like, if there were a material world, this is a reasoning to show how it doesn't really work to have a material world. And we say, then what is it? We're definitely experiencing hardness and materiality. And so his view is like, it's a projection of mind. So this is idealism, philosophical idealism. In the dictionary, says that the ultimate essential reality or nature of reality lies in consciousness, not material phenomena, and that only mental states are actually knowable. That's this Webster's dictionary, but that's kind of what Vasubandhu was proposing. So that's another Buddhist view that kind of unravels the early Buddhist view of atoms, right? It still keeps the view of no independent self, but it goes further. And now, in this view, it's no longer like Michael and I are separate bodies and minds. We're like, we're kind of projections of consciousness. We're not separate physically and materially, although we appear and feel that way. And so, again, I would say it changes our emotional experience. And it can change our conduct. I think this is why the Buddhists are emphasizing this philosophy, not just for its own sake. Change the way we live in the world. So, lots more could be said, and even within the Zen schools, there's examples of how they have different views. As they get more and more agreement, there's also more and more subtle debate. So, questions about all this?
I do have one.
Yeah.
I started out with Mahayana and Vajrayana. Mm-hmm. I began practicing, and only later, decades later, I actually became acquainted with the Theravada and read more widely the sutras. And as far as I can see, although the Buddha made really clear that there is no independent self, he never said that there is no self. And when they ask him the question, he refused to answer.
Yeah, really what he mainly said was, this body is not myself, the feelings are not myself, the perceptions are not, right.
But he also never said, specifically, I can't remember whom, asking, you know, if there is not a self, that means there is no self, and he refused to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As you, I'm sure you know, the Theravada view is that it's incorrect to say there is a self, but it's also incorrect to say that there is no self.
Yeah, well, like in Vajrayana and Zen, they start bringing in this word self again. right? And then the self-enjoyment samadhi we talk about in Zen is like the self that's always enjoying itself. So self starts getting used positively again, in particularly Zen and Vajrayana, and it's a little bit controversial. There's some articles these days that some people say Zen is not really Buddhism because they actually teach this doctrine of self. But that's why usually when they say there's no independent, permanent, separate self, or usually say the three qualities that are usually used in this argument, there's no permanent, independent, singular self. But Buddha nature is sometimes talked about, a permanent, independent, singular self. So that's why today I added in another word called individual. So that's the difference from Buddha nature is not an individual self. And here we're talking about big self. We're not talking about, this is not the self. It's actually a completely different thing because the self I was talking about earlier is the self that when someone insults us, we feel like, that's not fair, they said that to me. Well, the big self doesn't feel like that way.
Yeah, some of it is semantics, and I find that sometimes people can argue within Buddhist communities about this issue of self and emptiness.
We have to really define terms.
Yeah, but some of it is really initial semantics on what you mean by this.
Yeah, big self, small self, and what exact. So I think just adding in this word individual, I don't think any Buddhist traditions would say there's a truly existing, permanent, individual, separate self that we each have, because that's not the Buddha nature teaching. So none of the, but they might say there is an unchanging, ever-present, true self that's called the unborn, ever-present, undying awareness that we all share, Buddha nature. So two totally different selves.
Particularly exhaustion and all that, but I never heard the Tibetans use the term self applied to Buddha nature.
Yeah. But the Buddhist tradition does do that. Zen and also Mahayana Sutras, particularly the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, is the one that really drives home this point that someone asked the Buddha, is there a self? Again, like those early teachings, you're right that he didn't answer, but in this later Mahayana Sutra, Mahakashyapa asks, world honored one, is there a self? And the Buddha says, yes, there is. It's called Tathagatagarbha, or Buddha nature. So, and then Zen seems to have picked up on this. So, maybe we can talk more at tea, too. I won't.
This could,
you know, there's a lot more views that I thought would be nice to bring out, but there's, of course, there's not time. But just to end with Dogen. Dogen, I think Dogen, sometimes you can find different Buddhist views within Dogen, but he definitely has an idealistic slant, idealism bent to his teaching, but not, sometimes he doesn't bring that out so strongly. But here's a final view of Dogen's Zen view or understanding in an essay called Ungraspable Mind, or Mind Cannot Be Grasped is the name of this essay. Dogen says, there is Buddha mind that is walls, tiles, and pebbles. Buddhas in the past, present, and future realize it as ungraspable. So we could say the Buddha mind is ungraspable, but also the walls, tiles, and pebbles that are Buddha mind, they are also ungraspable. Walls, tiles, and pebbles are just Buddha mind. Buddhas in the past, present, and future realize them as ungraspable. Furthermore, the ungraspableness of mountains, rivers, and the great earth is within the self. So there's that word. The ungraspableness is the mind. So the ungraspableness of mountains, rivers, and the great earth, as mountains, rivers, and earth, is within the self. The ungraspableness is the mind. There's many things Dogen says like this. So, I think particularly this shift from realism to idealism is a huge leap for any human being, including myself, to make, because it flies in the face of the way we perceive the world since, if not the day we were born, a few weeks after we were born. So it's been an issue in Buddhism because it's so hard to swallow. But I just wanted to mention that this view, so there's another view that this talk partly arose because I always hear people talking about Buddha Dharma, and I hear these different views that we're trying to put into our own words, and I'm always trying to fit them into which of the Buddhist views is this. So the view that I would call the stardust view is sometimes I've heard that in here. It's like, we are all just stardust that's constant, and I'm not sure what stardust means exactly, but I think it means like these partless particles that are like the first atoms from the Big Bang are not changing, but they're just being rearranged into human bodies and planets and different stuff, and we're all made of the same stardust constantly changing itself, but there's no essential individual self. So I would call that a materialist Buddhist view. It's a valid Buddhist view, but it's a pre-Mahayana view called the stardust view. You see how that's like a little materialistic? And even if we say this stardust I'm talking about is not material particle, tiny material particles, it's energy. I hear that word sometimes in Zen centers. I think it's people trying to skirt around the issue of materialism. It's just energy transforming itself, and which is a very vague term that doesn't come up in all of the Buddha's teachings. So we'd have to define what we mean by it. But if it's anything like, say, radio waves I think waves, any kind of waves, electromagnetic waves, energy waves, gamma waves, I say tonight that it's still a materialistic view. That's still physics of an external world that exists independent of mind. Yeah, the waves were there before consciousness. So it's starting to shift into from realism to idealism, but anyway.
It's time, guys. We're like over time.
So, because we live in a small can, do we not?
Time and space.
We live in a small can of time and space, and it's time for the talk to end. So now we can go outside the can if we want, and talk outside the can. So, any merit generated from our exploration of understanding and view, may we offer it to all beings everywhere. May they be relieved from any subtle fixation on materiality. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.